conduction, the same word Corrine used to describe my own power. For how it conducted, seemingly at will, the task from the shackled fields of the South to the free lands of the North. But this Moses kept her own counsel and declined to give the Virginia Underground any notion of how she worked. And so I was left to my own devices, or more properly stated, I was left to their devices. We decided to experiment. First, we all agreed that to trigger the power, I needed some kind of stimulation, some kind of threat or pain even. And two, it was thought, from my own testimony, that the power was tied to the indelible moments of my life, and in my own mind I remembered that it might be connected specifically to my mother. But how to summon those memories up and make them serve? Corrine and her lieutenants employed all manner of tricks to draw me out. Hawkins shackled me and asked me to recount in every detail the betrayal of Georgie Parks. Mr. Fields blindfolded me, then took me out into the forest and asked for every detail of the day I plunged into the goose. Amy and I met at the stable and I recounted everything I knew of the crime my father had put upon my mother. I drove Corrine in a carriage one Saturday and recalled all that I felt while taking Sophia to meet my uncle. But no blue light of conduction came to me, and when I finished my story, though my hosts might be well riveted and my own heart in tatters from the memories, I was always exactly where I had begun. The afternoon after the drive, after another aborted attempt at conduction, Corrine and I walked together up to the main house and into the dining area. Mr. Fields and Hawkins were there drinking coffee. They greeted us both and then departed. Summer was well upon us with its long days, which meant less cover for our rehearsals. I remember the earth waking up that year and the transcendent feeling that I was waking up with it, but still no conduction. We sat at the table and continued our conversation until we had exhausted all the small things. And then Corrine said, "Hiram, the truth is that by the lights of any other standard, you have made yourself into a fine agent. This will be a particular boon to us because you shall be deployed according to our needs and not your limits. Perhaps this means nothing to you, but it should. Not everyone makes it here, you know." In fact, the compliment did mean something to me. I had lived the whole of my life in service of my father and my brother. Every step I took, any accomplishment fulfilled by me, even those made possible by my father, was received as a threat to the rightful order of things. For the first time in my life, I was aligned with the world around me. But I wondered what became of those who did not make it, those who'd been entrusted with all the secrets of the Virginia Underground, but revealed themselves to be liabilities. I knew so much now, too much, I thought, to ever be released back into the world. "The truth is, we expected none of this," she continued. "We knew you were red, we knew of your gift of memory, we knew you had been raised proximate to society. But we had not counted on how easily you would assume the mask. We knew you had been hunted, but we had not known how much guile you'd truly taken up in your time down under." She paused here, and I knew that we were entering into a darker portion of her conversation. She was looking down, struggling for her words. I thought then of the mastery she once displayed over me back at Lochless, back in my father's library, and how it had, in this moment especially, fled from her, and it occurred to me then that it really was all an illusion, that this entire order was engineering, was sorcery, all of it held up by elaborate display, by rituals and race day, by fancies and parades, by powders and face paint. It was all device. And now stripped of it, I saw that we really were just two people, a man and woman sitting here. I suddenly wanted to alleviate her obvious discomfort, and so I did that which I so often declined. I spoke. "And that is not enough," I said. "The running, the reading, the writing, it is not why I was brought here. So it is not enough."
"No,"
said Corrine. It is not. Hiram, there are enemies in this world that cannot simply be outrun. And there are a whole assortment of our own held deep in the coffin of slavery. Too deep for us to reach. Jackson, Montgomery, Columbia, Natchez. But this power, this conduction, this is the railroad that might turn a week's journey into an instant. Without it, we can menace our enemy. With it, distance is nothing to us, and we might strike at him wherever. In short, we need you, Hiram. Not just as Hiram, the forger of letters, and the Hiram, the running man, but as one who can return these people, our people, to the freedom given to all.
I understood her well, but I was still thinking of those who failed to meet the expectations. And what will you do with me should I never again achieve it? I asked. Hold me here forever amongst your forgeries? Hold me back down into the hole?
Of course not, Corrine said. You are free.
Free. There was something in how she said this that caught me. It rankled, though I could not then quite say why. Free, you say. But I will serve, you said it yourself, and serve as you decide and determine. I do what you want. I go where you say.
You assume too much of me, she said.
Who else is there? I asked. What is this underground beyond what I have seen here? Who is being moved? I have not seen them. What about my people? What about Sophia? What about Pete? What about Thena? What about my mother?
We have rules, she said.
Rules for what? I said.
Rules for who can be gotten out and how, she said.
Right, I replied. Then let me see them.
The rules? She replied, puzzled.
No, I said. Let me see the action. Let me see these people we are bringing out.
No. Much better. You say I have exceeded all expectation. Then let me do the thing myself.
Hiram, she said, and her voice was now low and filled with worry. I think she knew that she could lose me right there, that if she did not prove to me that this was not all some trick, I would be gone, and any hope of conduction would go with it.
Very well, she said. You want me to show you?
I will show you. No games? I asked. This is for real?
More real than you think, she said.
Chapter 14. But for Corrine to admit me into the deepest sanctums of the underground, she had to ensure that I would never leave. For this reason, she demanded something of me to bind me for good to the cause. And what she demanded was the destruction of Georgie Parks. I had dreamt of such a deed in jail, in the pit, and then here had long contemplated all that I might vent upon Georgie. But now I saw that faced with the thing, the sword in my hand, all my wrath faded in the face of the full shape of what must necessarily follow.
You were not the first he betrayed, said Corrine, and you were not the last. He is back there at Starfall right now, plying his devious trade. It was late night. I was down in the library with Hawkins and Corrine. I had just finished my studies for the evening, and I knew, hearing them, that I had not yet come to terms with all that Georgie had done. Some part of me still saw him as he had been mythologized. Georgie, the tasking man who seized upon his own liberty. To fully accept his betrayal was to accept the fullness of what had been done to us. How thoroughly they had taken us in, so that even our own heroes, our own myths, were but tools to further maintain the task. The plan, they explained to me, was to use our gifts of mimicry and fraud to implicate Georgie in a betrayal. Not a betrayal of the tasked, but of Georgie's own taskmasters.
You know what they'll do to him, I said.
If he lucky, they'll hang him, said Hawkins.
And if he ain't, I said, they'll clap him in chains, break his family, send him Natchez way, and work him worse than anything he know. And God forbid the tasking folk find out why he down there.
Likely, they'll tell him, said Hawkins.
We crossing into something here, I said, or y'all done already crossed and asking me to follow.
I say, we just kill him outright,
said Hawkins, marching past my concern. You know we can't do that, said Corrine. She was right, but not out of any moral principle. It was too obvious, and if reprisals did not find us, they would certainly find every tasking soul in the region. No. Georgie Parks must be dealt with, and it must be his masters who did the deed. We would simply offer mild encouragement.
These people, I know them well, Corrine said, shaking her head. Whatever agreement they have with Georgie, I promise you that they trust a free man less than the slave. And Georgie is a known liar, even in their service, a man who bends under power. Is it so hard to imagine him bending under another power still?
The underground, I said.
Or what they believe the underground to be?
Corrine replied.
And what if some notice might be found in a distinguished home marking the breadth of his sins, his efforts to work both sides, his feckless enslavement to this underground? And what if then a package of effects, forged passes, free papers, the literature of abolition, and missives indicating a northward journey, were to be located in Georgie's home or on his person?
We killing him, I said.
We are, said Hawkins.
By the rope or by the chain, I said, we are setting to kill that man.
That man meant to kill you, Corrine said,
her gray eyes filling with a low anger.
He meant to kill you, Hiram. He's killed many before you, and if we do nothing, he will keep killing. This is a man who takes the last hope of freedom and burns it for fuel. Little girls, old men, whole families, he burns them all. Have you ever been deep into the South?
I have.
It is hell worse than the stories say. Endless toil, endless degradation. No man deserves this, but if any did, it would be the masters themselves first, and men like Georgie Parks second.
The logic of it all was clear, but I felt myself now slipping into something darker, something far beyond the romance I imagined for myself when I set off that night with Sophia. The task was a trap. Even Georgie was trapped. And so who was Corrine Quinn to judge such a man? Who was I who'd run with no higher purpose save my own passions and my own skin? Now I understood the underground war. It was not the ancient and honorable kind. No armies amassed at the edges of the field. For every one agent, there were 100 quality, and for every quality, there were 1,000 low whites sworn to them. The gazelle does not match claws with the lion. He runs. But we did more than run. We plotted. We instigated. We sabotaged. We poisoned. We destroyed.
It's on us, said Hawkins. Do you get that it's on us? He is out there breaking families, sending folk to the jails, to the auction, and he is doing it in our name.
We did not ask for this, Hiram, said Corrine.
You are right. It is not our normal work. But what would you have us do? What is the option we have not yet conceived?
There was none. Now Corrine produced another file and put it before me on the table, and I knew what was within. The usual assortment of stolen documents that might help put me in the mind of the quality. Then Corrine looked at me, and the look was not of pity or sorrow. It was fire. A month later, I walked out of my quarters in my flannels to begin the evening routine. It was full summer now. The nights had shortened and the days had begun their July sprawl. On the path from my quarters, I saw Hawkins approaching with Mr. Fields, both in their day clothes. Hawkins made small talk, while Mr. Fields' eyes darted to and fro. I felt that something was coming. Hawkins looked me up and down and said, No work tonight. Tomorrow, neither. Get some rest.
I looked at him a little longer to see if I correctly caught his meaning.
We got one, he said.
But I did not rest. Neither that evening, that night, nor the next morning. I had only the vaguest notions of the underground's methods in the field, and my mind ran circuits trying to imagine. They met me outside the following evening. I wore a pair of comfortable trousers, a shirt, hat, and the same pair of brogans I had thought to run in. I tried my best to conceal my excitement, but then I met eyes with Hawkins and he laughed.
What? I asked.
Huh. Nothing, said Hawkins. It's just you can't go back. You can't get out.
You know that, right?
Long past the getting out point, I said.
Indeed, said Hawkins. But it is a load we putting on you. And I'm feeling all that you about to feel right now, looking at you. And I'm remembering myself when they first brought me into all this. You about to see.
He can't know, Mr. Field said. And besides, what else is there now? We walked up from the quarters toward the main house of Bryston and convened in one of the side buildings. There was a table with three cups and a jar, and from the jar Hawkins poured three servings of hard cider. He took a sip, sucked in a stream of air, then said,
In a sense, it's an easy one. About a day's journey south of here, and then a day's journey back. Just one man.
And in another sense, I asked?
It's one man, a real man, he said. This ain't hopping or running or some spell down the library. This is real patrol, real hounds out there who'd like nothing better than to carry you off.
Hawkins ran his hands through his hair and shook his head. I had the sense that he was more scared for me than I was for myself.
All right, listen, he said. Man's name is Parnell Johns. He done did something to get him in bad with the local tasking folks. Had a grift he was running, stealing from his master and selling it to some of the low whites. His master knew something was off, but could not figure on what.
So he took it out on all of them, I said.
Surely did, said Mr. Fields, and he did so with interest, working the whole plantation double time to get it back, beatings if they come up short.
Johns kept stealing, I asked.
No, he stopped, said Mr. Fields. But it didn't matter. His master just went ahead and now this is the new theory of the home place.
Master take it out on the taskin' folks, said Hawkins.
And the taskin' folks take it out on Johns, I said.
With time and a half, he got no people now. His country ain't his country, said Hawkins. And he won't out.
Sounds like a piece of work to me, I said, shaking my head. Surely there are taskin' folks more deserving of justice.
Course there are, said Hawkins. But we ain't bringing justice to Johns, we bringing it to his master.
What? I said.
You see, Johns, whatever his cowardly ways, is a hell of a field hand, said Hawkins. And he's more than that. He's something of a genius, plays the violin, even works the wood like you.
What's that got to do with freedom? I asked.
Nothing, said Hawkins. It ain't about freedom. It's about war.
I paused and looked them both over.
No, don't start that, said Hawkins. Don't start thinking again. Remember where that got you the last time. There's a bigger thing here, a higher plan.
And what's that? I asked.
Hiram, Mr. Field said, it's for your own good, for all of our good. You don't want to know it all. Just trust us on that.
He paused for a moment to see if I could catch on, and then he said,
It is hard to trust. I understand. Believe me, I do. All you have been met with since our first meeting are deceptions. I am sorry for that. It is not always an honorable life. And so perhaps it would help if you were given some bit of truth, even if it does not pertain to our journey this night. I want you to know my real name, Iron. It is not Isaiah Fields. It is Micajah Bland. Mr. Fields is a name I've assumed for my work here in Virginia. I would appreciate you using it for as long as We are down here, but it is not the name to which I was born. So I have trusted you now with something most precious, something that could get me killed. Will you now trust us? And so our journey began, Hawkins, myself, and Mikaja Bland. We did not run. For all the training, we merely walked. But we took a brisk pace, avoiding main roads and going through the pathless backwoods and over hills, until the woodlands flattened and I knew from this and our respective orientation to the stars that we must be headed east. The land was dry, the night warm. I knew by then that this was the worst season to conduct, simply because of the brevity of the sunless hours when we could travel. Winter was the field agent's high season. In summer with fewer hours, precision of arrival and departure was everything. We walked for 6 hours or so, roughly, to the southeast. John's was just where he was supposed to be, at the crossing of two paths in the forest distinguished by a woodpile on the right end. Standing in the woods, we saw him pacing in his nervousness. It was my first mission, and I was entrusted with making the contact. We worked in teams, but only one man made contact at first. By this method, should we be betrayed, only one of us would fall. I stepped out from beyond the trees and approached. Johns stopped pacing. He had come just as he had been told to. No bundles, no extra effects, only the forged papers in his hand, in case of Ryland. Surveying him, I confess myself mixed. There had always been men like him, those who, for their own amusement, menaced an entire tasking team. In the days of my grandmother, Santy Bess, they had ways of dealing with such men. An accidental fall in the woods, a spooked horse, a pinch of pokeweed, and now I must work to free such a scoundrel, while good men, women, and children lay buried under. I looked at him hard and said, "Ain't no moon over the lake tonight," he said.
"That's 'cause the lake had its fill with the sun."
"Come on," I said. He paused for a second, looked to the woods, and motioned. And then out came a girl, perhaps about 17, in field overalls with her hair tied under a cloth. And this is why such men as Parnell Johns were fed to the pokeweed. Every act of normal sympathy was to them an invitation to leverage. Give them a calf, and they demand the herd. I thought for a moment of leaving them right there. But this was a matter for those more senior than I. So I said nothing, and led them back into the forest to the small area where Hawkins and Bland were waiting.
"Who the hell is she?" said Hawkins.
"She with me," said Johns.
"Hell are you saying?" said Hawkins. "We had arrangements for one cargo, and now you trying to dump more."
"It's my daughter, Lucy," he said.
"Don't care if it's your mama," said Hawkins. "You know the plan. What the hell are you doing?"
"I ain't leaving without her," said Johns.
"It's all right," said Bland. "It's all right." Hawkins and Bland were friends. I knew this because Hawkins could make Bland laugh. Not just giggle, but uproariously laugh. And Mikaja Bland did not much laugh. Hawkins shook his head, frustrated. Then he looked at Johns and said,
"If we get even a sniff of Ryland, I am dropping you both. You got it? We know the way north. You don't. If I get a hint of anything strange, we will drop you here and leave you for the hounds."
But there wasn't anything strange, or at least not in the way Hawkins suspected. We kept a good pace for the rest of the night and had made some good distance by daybreak. Hawkins and Bland had scouted the land well. They found a cave for a midpoint rest, and we arrived there just as the sun came up over the hills. We took turns sleeping and keeping guard over our cargo. Contrary to what Hawkins said, we could not leave them. We could not risk any word getting out about our methods. If they became too much of a load, I feared what might be done. We took 3-hour shifts. I took the last one, late in the afternoon until nightfall. Everybody was asleep except for me and Lucy, who was having trouble adjusting to the time of things.
I watched Lucy step out of the cave and into the open air. I did not stop her, but followed just behind. She was not John's daughter. That I could tell. They shared not a single feature. He was high yellow, and she was dark as Africa itself. But more than that, it was in the way they walked, held hands, and whispered to each other.
"I don't know why he lied," she said.
"Nervous," I said. We were just outside the cave. I was seated on a stump behind her. She was watching the sun as it began to bed down in the west.
"He didn't want to do it," said Lucy. "Don't blame him. It was all me. You know, he got a family, right? A real family? A woman at the other place. Two daughters."
I don't know what it is about me that made people want to unburden themselves, but I knew from her mention of Parnell John's family where we were going, and so we went.
"Master Heath, who owns us, used to have this young wife," she said. "She was cruel as all hell. I know. I was her servant girl. She was the type to take the whip to you 'cause it rained too hard or the milk was too warm. She was as pretty as she was mean, and all the men in town knew. Master Heath held her tight for fear of losing her. He was the jealous kind. Well, one day that young wife took to religion. Wasn't sincere for what I could tell, but it was a way to see some of the world. She got friendly with this old pastor, come around every day and minister the good word. And it got real clear to me, though not to Master Heath, that he was ministering more than that."
Here Lucy laughed at her own insinuation and then turned to me to see if I caught on. And though I had, there was no real register in me, and this somehow made her laugh even more. And then she said,
"You know, they left one day, just up and ran out, picked up and, I'm guessing, started all new. I hated that girl. And in some just other life, I do declare I will be holding the whip and she'll be underneath. But I could still see the beauty in it, you know? We talked about it," she said. "Dreamt about it. Dreamt about it all the time. It was powerful, I tell you. But we knew it could never be us. We was tasking folk."
Now she turned back away, and I heard her crying a bit.
"And then it happened," she said. "Listen, I look young, but I ain't so young. I've been left by a man before. I know what it looked like. I know that face. And he came to me with that face, and before he said a word, he broke down and cried, because he knew that I knew he was gone. Don't blame him. He wouldn't say where. He wouldn't even say how. Just that come the next morning, he'd be gone, and he'd be going without me. They say Parnell's a scoundrel. Well, so am I, and he is my scoundrel. His crime is he don't want to live just, and how can a man when the whole house is wrong? They blame him for what Master Heath do to them, but I blame Master Heath. I followed him last night. Caught him out in the trail sometime before he got to you, and I told him he either take me or I was going to go back and tell him he was running. I never would have done it. Ain't built that way, but I tell you this to say it was me. He was too weak to leave me."
"Don't make it right," I said.
"The hell I care about right," she said. "Hell I care about you or your men. You know what they did to us back there? You done forgot? You don't remember what they do to the girls down here? And once they do it, they got you. They catch you with the babies, tie you to the place by your own blood and all, until you got too much to let go of to go. Well, I got as much right to run as Parnell. Much right as you or anyone."
Lucy was no longer crying now. Unburdened,
She walked back to the cave where the rest were beginning to rise. Hawkins gave me a wary look. I saw him but paid no heed. I focused on Lucy, who had by then walked over to smiling Parnell Johns and laughingly embraced him. We made good time that night. By midnight the moon was high and I could see the mountains in the distance. And I knew then that we were near Bryston. We kept going right past it. An hour or two later we found ourselves at a small cabin. Smoke rose from the chimney, and firelight flickered in the window. Hawkins whistled. He waited, then he whistled again, waited, then whistled one last time. The fire went out inside, we waited a few minutes longer, then we followed Hawkins around to the back. A door opened and out came an old white woman. She walked over to us and said,
"The 250 been late all week."
Hawkins said, "No, I believe the schedule changed." At that the woman said,
"You said was only one of them."
"Sure did," said Hawkins. "Not my notion. You do with them what you will." She studied the group for a second and said,
"All right. You all get in here quick."
We walked inside, and we helped this old woman start up the fire again. Hawkins stepped outside with her. They talked for a few minutes and then returned. Hawkins said,
"I reckon it's time for us to make our way home."
Mukaja Bland turned to Parnell Johns. I could see the tenderness of his face against the firelight. "Don't worry," he said. "You'll be fine." Johns nodded, and then as we walked out he said,
"When we safe, can I send word to my daddy?"
Hawkins laughed to himself and turned back.
"You most certainly can," he said, "but if the underground find out, it'll be the last word you ever speak."
With this now done, and with my actions against Georgie Parks, it was felt by Corrine and by others that it was time for me to see more of the underground's work, to journey out of the country of slavery and into the North. Philadelphia would be my new home. I was given a few days' notice, and was lucky to have even that. The underground would give me no chance to reconsider, for though we all dreamed of going north, all sorts of fears might overrun a man when the dream descended into the real. There is always a part of us that does not want to win, wants to stay down in the low and familiar. And so there was no time to think and submit to the cowardly parts of me. I spent my last days in counsel and reflection. I talked with Mukaja Bland about what to expect. I walked the woods and thought of all that I once took for normal, but would soon be without. Those of us working in some new terrain had to take up a new identity and be furnished with papers. The house agent never made his own. They were furnished by other house agents from other stations. For it was thought that no man could author his own life. They began with the root of my occupation, woodworking at a local company that was a cover for the underground's operations. I was to be a man who'd purchased his freedom and fled in the wake of certain recent laws that choked the rights of free coloreds in the South. I was given two sets of working clothes and another set for church. My name stayed the same with one addition, the surname Walker. There was still the matter of how precisely to get there. Ryland's hounds trolled the roads, harbors, and railways. We were aided by the fact that there would be no runaway report for me, and thus no Ryland searching for a man of my description. We decided on the train. I would be joined by Hawkins and Mukaja Bland. Our plan was simple. I was a free man. Hawkins, a slave belonging to this Bland, a white man, his proprietor. Should I at any point find my papers under challenge, Bland would offer his testimony as to the identity.
"Act like a free man," Hawkins advised. "Lift your head. Look them in the eye, though not for too long. You are still colored. Bow before the ladies. Be sure to bring some of them books of which you are so fond. Remember, own the acre, or they will see right through you."
On our day out, I held these notions, and when my nerves came upon me, as when procuring my ticket, as when handing my trunk to the boy for stowing, as when the train pulled off in the South and everything I had known fell away, I simply told myself this thing that must become my truth. I am free. Chapter 15. I departed with few effects to my name and no real farewells. I saw neither Corrine nor Amy that last evening and assumed them both involved in some mischief of their own. I left on a hot summer Monday morning, 4 months after my arrival at Bryston. We walked most of that day, Hawkins, Bland, and I, and spent that night in the small farmhouse of an old widower sympathetic to our cause. Then that Tuesday, we set out separately for the town of Clarksburg, where the first leg of our journey would commence. The plan was to cross through the state by the Northwestern Virginia Railroad, and then in western Maryland we'd link up with the Baltimore and Ohio, proceed east and then north up into the free lands of Pennsylvania, and find our destination in Philadelphia. There was a shorter route due north, but there had been some recent troubles along the rail there with Ryland's hounds, and it was felt that the audacity of this direct approach right through the slave port of Baltimore would not be expected. When I reached the Clarksburg station, I spotted Hawkins and Bland sitting beneath a red awning. Hawkins was fanning himself with his hat. Bland was looking down the track in the opposite direction from where the train would approach. A flock of blackbirds sat on the awning. On the platform I saw a white woman in bonnet and blue hoop dress holding the hands of two well-dressed toddlers. Some distance away, outside the shade of the awning, a low-white with what I guessed to be all his possessions in a carpet bag smoked a tobacco. I stood off to the side, not wanting to inspire suspicion with any presumption of cooling shade. The low-white finished his tobacco and then greeted the woman. They were still talking when the blackbirds flew from the awning and the great iron cat roared around the bend, all black smoke and ear-splitting clanking. I watched as the wheels turned slower and slower and came to a screeching stop. I had never seen anything like it outside of a book. I presented my ticket and papers to the conductor, gingerly. He barely looked at them. It may be hard to believe now, in these dark days, but there was no nigger car. Why would there be one? The quality kept their tasked ones close the way a lady keeps her clutch, closer even. For this was a time in our history when the most valuable thing a man could own in all of America was another man. I headed to the back, walking in the aisle between the two rows of seating. The train idled for a few minutes. I tried not to look nervous, but when I heard the conductor yell and the great cat roared again, I felt every inch of me loosen and relax. The entire journey took 2 days. So that I arrived at Gray's Ferry Station overlooking the Schuylkill River on Thursday morning. I stepped off into the crowd of people searching for friends and family. I saw Hawkins and Bland as soon as I was off the train, but they gave me a wide berth, for it was known that even here in the city, Ryland prowled searching for runaways. I had been given no description of my escort. I was told to merely wait. There was an omnibus across the street hitched to a team of horses. Several of the train passengers stepped on board. "Mr. Walker?" I turned and saw a colored man in gentleman's clothes before me. "Yes," I said. "Raymond White," he said, extending his hand. He did not smile. "This way," he said, and we walked over to the omnibus and boarded. The driver cracked a carriage whip, and we pulled away in the direction opposite of the river. We did not talk much during the ride, and this was to be expected given the business that had brought us together. Nevertheless, I was able to take the measure of this Raymond White. His dress was impeccable. He wore a perfectly cut gray suit that angled down from his shoulders to his cinched waist. His hair was neat and parted. His face seemed a stone with features cut into it, and for the whole of that ride, no expression of pain, annoyance, joy, humor, nor concern moved those features. Yet I thought that I saw a sadness in his eyes that, despite all Raymond's forbearing elegance, told a story, and I knew, if not how, that his life was somehow tied to the task. And from that sadness, I drew that his high manner, his nobility, was no simple matter of birth, but of labor and struggle. The omnibus cut away from the river into the heart of the city.
There were people everywhere on the streets. I could see them out the windows, so many people, so that it seemed to me as though race day had gathered a hundredfold, as though the whole of the world had gathered there, gathered to heave between the workshops and fur dealerships and druggists, to walk the stone-chipped streets, to inhale the acrid air. Every rank of person in every configuration, parent and child, rich and poor, black and white. And I saw that the rich were mostly white and the poor mostly black. But there were also members of both tribes and both classes. It was a shock to see it directly, for if whites held the power here, and they did not seem to hold it exclusively. And I tell you, I had never seen more miserable specimens of the white race and never more luxurious specimens of the colored race than I saw that day. The coloreds here were not merely surviving as they did in Starfall. They were sometimes dressed in garments more elegant than anything I'd seen on my father. And they were out there in the churning city, in their hats and gloves and their ladies under their parasols, moving like royalty. This astonishing portrait was set against the most offensive odors known to man. I did not smell the air here in this city so much as feel it. It seemed to be born in the gutters, then rose up to mingle with the dead horses in the street, and finally joined the fumes of manufacture and production until the odor, an orchard left to rot, was an invisible fog that hung over the whole city. I was used to all the malicious odors of livestock, but alongside the gardens, the strawberry bushes, the woods. But the smell of Philadelphia offered no such balance. It hung everywhere, over every street, in the workshops and taverns. And, I would discover, if care was not taken, it drifted into homes and bedchambers. We got off the omnibus, after 20 minutes or so, and entered into a brick row house on the corner, where we found Bland and Hawkins already installed. They were just past the foyer, in a small parlor, drinking coffee with another well-dressed black man. Seeing us, the whole party smiled and looked up. The man whom I did not know stood, strode over, and gave a big handshake and bigger smile. I could tell from his features that he was kin to Raymond White. He had the same stone face, but not the stoicism.
"Othah White," he said, introducing himself. "No trouble on the rail, right?"
"Not that I can tell," I said.
"Here, have a seat," said Othah. "I'll bring you all some coffee."
I sat while Raymond and Bland made small talk. Othah returned with coffee, and then the conference began.
"Take care of this man, you hear?" Hawkins said, drinking his coffee. "He is the genuine article. This is not idle talk. Seen him buried under a river and dig himself out. He done suffered everything we could throw at him, and he's still standing. Should tell you something."
This was the kindest thing Hawkins had ever said to me. "You know my commitments," Raymond said. "My whole life is given to this, and we gladly welcome his aid in our business."
"We could really use you," said Othah. "I don't know you, Hiram Walker, but I wasn't raised here either. But I learned, and I think you will too."
Hawkins nodded, took a drink from his coffee. Hawkins seemed more at ease with Othah, born in slavery, than Raymond, a creature of the North. I think now, through the lens of years, that it was a matter of how we worked. In Virginia, we were outlaws, a matter that soon became our honor, so that we reveled in being beyond the morals of a world we believed to be premised in demon law. We were not Christians. Christians plied their trade in the North where the underground was so strong as to not be an underground at all. I can recall now many nights sitting in some Philadelphia tavern, listening to men, conducted only days earlier, boasting of the details of their flight. Whole city blocks teemed with fugitives, and these fugitives populated congregations, where they were organized into vigilance committees who guarded each other and watched for Ryland. In the North, the agents of the underground were not outlaws. Indeed, they were very nearly a law unto themselves. They stormed jails, attacked federal marshals, and shot it out with Ryland's hounds.
Men like Hawkins plied their trade in the shadows. Men like Raymond shouted in the town square. But for Otha, it was different. There was something about him, something about his implied roots and rough manner that compelled deference from Hawkins, however deeply buried and unacknowledged. For Hawkins was a man given to saving souls, not peering into them, least of all his own. I know enough of what Bryston was before Corrine's transformation, of its atrocities, to know that soul-peering was a luxury.
All right, Hawkins said, now rising. The boy don't know nothing. I am relying on you to fill him in. We have done our part. May he serve the cause here as well as he done served it down there.
I rose, and Hawkins turned to me, shook my hand, and said,
Doubtful we'll be seeing each other again any time soon, if at all. All I can say is, be good.
I nodded. Hawkins shook hands with the others, Bland included, who, it was decided, should remain in Philadelphia a few weeks for business of his own. After Hawkins left, Otha took me upstairs to my quarters while Raymond and Bland remained below to talk. It was a small room, but after months of living in common, and before that, living in the hole, and before that, the jail, it was heaven. After Otha left, I lay across the bed. I could hear muffled intercourse of Bland and Raymond floating up from below, and the sounds of what seemed to me boisterous laughter. Later, I took my supper with Otha at a local tavern. He explained that I would have a long weekend to orient myself in the city. Planning the next day to explore, I came straight home and slept. Otha slept here too, in a bedroom next to mine. Raymond stayed outside the city with his wife and children. I rose early the next morning to see Philadelphia. I walked out onto Bainbridge Street, one of the city's great thoroughfares just adjacent to our office on 9th Street, and watched the variety of human life, a menagerie of wants, needs, and intentions teeming in the streets, and it was only 7 a.m. On the other side of the street I saw a bakery, and through the window I could see a colored man at work. I walked in and was greeted with a sweet smell, the perfect antidote to the fog of the city. On the counter there was a pleasing array of treats, cakes, fritters, and dumplings of all kinds, laid out on parchment. Behind the counter, more still, stacked on trays suspended in slotted shelves.
New around here, are you?
I looked up and saw the colored man smiling at me. He was perhaps 10 years my senior and regarded me with a look of pure kindness. I must have recoiled at his question because he said,
Don't mean to snoop. In fact, not snooping at all. I can see it in all the new ones. Just dazzled by the smallest things. It's okay, son. Nothing wrong with being new. Nothing wrong with being dazzled.
I said nothing.
Name's Mars, the man said. This is my place. Me and my Hannah. You from over near 9th Street, right? Staying with Otha over there? Raymond and Otha. They both my cousin. Blood to my dear Hannah. And you with them, so that make you family to me.
Still, I said nothing. How rude I was back then. How wide my suspicions sprawled.
How about this, he said.
And then, reaching behind him, Mars ripped off a piece of parchment from a roll and went into the back. He returned with something wrapped in the paper. And when he handed the package over to me, it was warm to the touch.
Go on, he said. Try it.
I opened the paper, and the scent of ginger wafted out. The smell evoked a feeling all at once, sad and sweet, because the feeling was attached to a lost memory that I had felt lurking somewhere down a winding, foggy path in my mind. What I owe you, I asked.
Owe me, Mars said. We family. What I tell you? We all family up here.
I nodded, managed a thanks, and then backed out of the bakery. I stood on Bainbridge for a moment watching the city, the gingerbread wrapped in paper still warm in my hand. I wished I had smiled before I left. I wished I had said something to reward his kindness. But I was fresh out of Virginia, fresh out of the pit, Georgie Park still on my mind, Sophia still lost to me. I walked across Bainbridge, west, across streets that counted up, pondering the absurd size of a town with so many streets they'd apparently run out of names. I walked on until I was at the docks, where I saw a mix of colored men and whites unloading and working on ships. I followed the river as it bent inward, then curved back out. Its banks were crowded with workshops, small factories, and dry docks. The oppressive scent of the city eased some against the cool river breeze. Now I came upon a promenade. There was a large green field dissected by walkways, themselves lined with benches. I took a seat. It was about 9 in the morning now. Friday, the end of the working week. The day was clear and blue. The promenade was filled with Philadelphians of all color and kind. Gentlemen and their boaters escorted ladies. A circle of school children sat in the grass hanging on the words of their tutor. A man rode past on a unicycle, laughing. It occurred to me just then that this was the freest I had ever been in my life. And I knew that I could leave right then. Right there, that I could abandon the underground and disappear into the city, into this massive race day, float away on the poisonous air. I opened the paper. I brought the gingerbread to my mouth, and as I ate, something inside me cracked open, unbidden. The path I'd seen back at Mars's bakery, the one called up by the scent of ginger, now appeared before me again, and this time there was no fog, and really there was no path, just a place. A kitchen, which I instantly recognized as belonging to Lochless. And I was no longer on the bench or even near the promenade. I was standing in that kitchen, and I saw on the counter cookies, pastries, and all manner of sweet things on trays lined with parchment paper, just as they had been back at Mars's bakery. And there was another counter adjacent to that one, and I saw behind it a colored woman singing softly to herself, kneading dough. And when she saw me, she smiled and said, "Why are you always so quiet, high?" And then she went back to kneading and singing to herself. Some time passed before she looked up at me again and laughed. "I see you there, Iron Master Howell's Ginger Snaps," she said. "You might be quiet, but you fixin' to get me in a whole mess of trouble." She shook her head and laughed to herself. But a few moments later I saw a look of caution on her face as she brought an extended index finger to her closed lips. She walked over to the door and peeked out, then walked back over to the counter filled with treats and pried 2 ginger snaps loose from the paper. "Family got to watch for each other," she said, offering these to me. "And furthermost, as I see it, all of this belonged to you anyway." I took the 2 cookies from her hands. I must have known what was happening. I must have realized, amidst it all, that whatever I then was, it was not the Lochless of now, was perhaps not even the Lochless of then. It was as though I were in a dream. And this woman before me, I could not name her, though I felt a pang of recognition and a pang of something more, of loss. And so strong was this feeling that I ran to her, the ginger snap still in my left hand, and hugged her, long and hard. And when I stepped away, she was smiling, big as day, big as the Baker Mars had smiled at me only that morning. "Don't forget," she said, "family." And then I saw the fog return, float into the kitchen from all around until the counter disappeared before me, and the trays disappeared before me, and the woman disappeared before me. And she said to me as she faded from my sight, "Now, get on." And then I was back, seated on the bench. I felt tired. I looked at my hands, which were now empty. I looked up and out past the promenade to the river. The man on the unicycle rode past again. He waved. I looked at the benches to my left and then my right. The line of benches continued on both sides with little difference, save this. 3 seats down, I saw a piece of half-eaten gingerbread on the bench, and in the grass the parchment in which it had been wrapped, blowing gently in the summer breeze. Chapter 16. Now I knew. That was conduction.
The power was still with me, even if I did not quite understand how to call it forth. I dragged myself, exhausted, back to our building and fell asleep as soon as I returned to my room, with the sun still out, and did not wake again until early the next morning. I thought to try to access the power again, but the fatigue and malady that I now saw accompanied every conduction dissuaded me. Instead, I decided to visit Mars's bakery again and apologize for my rude manner. Then, perhaps, walk through the city more to test the freedom, perhaps east this time toward the Delaware River, maybe even across it and into the small hamlet of Camden where Raymond and his family lived. But just as I pulled on my brogans, I heard a knock at my bedroom door and then Oath's voice.
"Hiram, you there?"
I opened my door and saw Otha already descending the staircase. He looked back up at me, still bounding down, and said,
"Gotta go."
I followed him down the steps and into the parlor, where we found Raymond pacing with a letter in hand. When he saw us, he walked to the door, grabbed his hat, and without a word, dashed out. We followed him out onto 9th Street and then to Bainbridge, which was already by then flush with the flow and miasma of Philadelphia. "The law of our state is quite clear," he said when we caught up to him. "No man or woman can be held under bondage, even if brought here under bondage. Haven, once requested, must be granted, but it must be requested. We cannot induce them to freedom. They cannot be wooed."
"But the masters," said Otha, looking at me, "they keep the law hidden. They tell their people lies, frighten them, threaten their families and friends."
"But when we have someone who clearly states their intentions," said Raymond, "then we are empowered to make sure those intentions are respected. And this Bronson woman has made such a request, one that her captor dishonors. Forgive my rush, but time is short. If we are to make this man honor the law, it must be done right now." We were headed east now, along the same path I had thought to take earlier that morning. Before long, we were at the docks, and I could see the Delaware lapping gently against the ships. It was now Saturday. Hot yet again, hotter in this city than anything I had ever known in Virginia. Shade had no meaning here. The heat followed you as sure as the odor, and the only relief I was coming to find was here at the shores of the city. We walked a few piers to the south until we stood before a gangplank of a riverboat. We boarded quickly. Raymond surveyed the passengers, but did not see anyone matching this Bronson woman he spoke of. Then a colored man said,
"They down below, Mr. White."
We walked to the back of the boat and found a set of stairs leading down. And there, in the belly, we saw another group of passengers. I recognized the Bronson woman before Raymond did. I needed no description. I had, in just my 2 days, seen my share of tasking folks. They were dressed as well as the free coloreds here, perhaps even better dressed, as though their captors sought to conceal the chain that extended between them. But if you watched long enough, you could see in their manner, in the particular way they attended, that some other power held them. And this Bronson woman was well-dressed, costumed even, the way Sophia would be costumed for Nathaniel, and I saw her arm was held tight by a tall, thin white man, and that with her other hand she held tighter still to a boy no older than 6. I watched her eyes spot Raymond, who was still searching, and then her eyes found mine, and then she looked away, turning her gaze to her son. By then Raymond had caught on. He walked over and said, "Mary Bronson, I understand you have made a request. We are here to see this request done in accordance with the law of our state, which shows neither respect," and now Raymond fixed his eyes on the tall, thin man, "nor regard for the customs of bondage." I was out of Virginia, cut from a world where our work was furtive, where I was a criminal who must respect the very customs I was working to destroy. But here I was in Philadelphia, watching an agent of the underground operate in the wide open, with no choreography, no costume. Raymond's words went off like a bomb, and the white man who held Mary Bronson felt it.
"Damn you,"
said the white man, yanking at Mary Bronson's hand so that she stumbled off balance a bit.
I mean to return with my property to my home country.
Raymond ignored him. You are under no order to obey, he said to Mary. He will not detain you while I stand, and should you come with me, I assure you the law of this state will reinforce my efforts.
Damn you! I have her, the man said.
This he said with great force. But I saw he no longer held Mary's arm. I don't know if she had slipped it free or if he, with his wrath focused on Raymond, had simply forgotten. By now, a small crowd had gathered near us, some to reinforce, some to see the source of the commotion. They informed each other of the details of the story. They grumbled and motioned toward the man who did not seem to perceive what little power he had withering around him. But Mary perceived it all. The crowd buoyed her. She took the hand of her child and walked toward Raymond. The man fumed, called for Mary to return, but she ignored him, positioning herself behind Raymond and the child behind her.